This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, R. Grant Kleiser. With me today is Professor Ashley W. M. Williard. Dr. Williard is an assistant professor in the Francophone Studies program at the University of South Carolina, where she teaches courses on the French language and Francophone world, including on topics such as Atlantic slavery, disability, and early modern gender. Her new book, entitled Engendering Islands, Sexuality, Reproduction, and Violence in the Early Modern French Caribbean, focuses on 17th century French Caribbean reconstructions of masculinity and femininity that, in her words, help sustain and justify occupation, slavery, and nascent ideas of race. Dr. Williard, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I'm very much looking forward to talking about with you about this extremely important monograph. So welcome.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation to talk to you about it.
Of course, of course. So before delving into your arguments, can you just set the scene for us? What is fundamental to understand about the historical context of the 17th century French Caribbean, and roughly, in your book, it's roughly 1635 to 1715?
So a few different threads that are important, I think, to trace and identify here. I mean, first of all, what came before? So, of course, indigenous presence, exchange, migration, before European presence and ongoing as well. And I especially focus on Kalinago, often referred to as Island Caribs in my texts, but also then thinking about inter-European competition, influence of Iberian models as the French are trying to establish their own colonies. That also going on with the background of all sorts of flux and developments in France itself. And I'm especially interested, of course, in the kinds of conflicts and tensions and contradictions that are present in France around issues of gender that then get transferred to the colonial context. So I'm thinking about the sort of contested position of women in France and how that influenced colonial endeavors and how we can sort of identify the translation of those issues in terms of salon culture, in terms of women regents in power over the course of the 16th and 17th century. And so it's really this time in which women's roles are in question, but then also the importance of masculinities and different models of masculinity were competing and developing along with Louis XIV's court specifically. So I'm thinking about all of these sorts of influences and how then they circulate to the ambitions of the French monarchy in the Caribbean. So specifically in their arrival in Saint Christophe, their rivalries with the English there, as well as, of course, ongoing contestation from Kalinago there, and then soon thereafter in Guadeloupe, Martinique, Saint-Domingue, although not officially a colony until much later, certainly a place where the French were present and participating in all sorts of exchange. So those are the sorts of tensions that I'm bringing my questions into, and I think it's an understudied period. So this earlier period, not because it's the beginning, but because it's a moment of flux. And for all of the reasons I just mentioned, but also because it is not a fully established colonial regime, though it is very quickly a place where many different people encountered each other and where models of slavery certainly come to bear on the racialization of slavery in those Caribbean colonies. So those are some things I can say to set the stage. Starts to answer your question.
Great. Thank you so much. So obviously, as you mentioned, gender and ideas of gender are very important in the 17th century, but of course race and the idea of race is important too. So in this book, how exactly do you define race?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question, and it's one that I'm continuing to sort of wrestle with because it's up for debate, of course, and it's not a word that's traditionally used, at least in the field of French literary studies, in which I'm trained and work. It's not traditionally used, I would say, in the modern sense to talk about the early modern period. And yet, I think it is completely pertinent to use that term to talk about here for my study, a broad categorization of people that is then used for oppressive purposes, for exploitation. And so I do not necessarily think that race as a concept needs to be defined by innate physical characteristics, though that is the most familiar form that we see, especially 18th, 19th century. But what I'm interested in is the ways in which race here in the 17th century is so clearly a shifting, adapting concept. And I believe that that is part of what is so dangerous, violent about race and the work that it does. And so I think it's a period where we see that even when race is not attached to a kind of eugenics movement that it would be later, are these very fixed categories, it still attaches to bodies in intersectional ways. Even though in the text that I'm looking at, mutable traits also have an influence. And so these aren't always what we would expect to call race because, you know, arguably they're linked. Some of the concepts that I identify as race or some of the discourses that I identify as race in the book are also very much influenced by what we now call culture, customs, but also conceptions of climate and also questions around religion and faith, which arguably could change, but I still believe it's the kind of attachment then and reuse of those traditional interpretations of human difference that that do count as race because of the way that they were used. And that can make visible the ways in which race remains a shifting, slippery concept that is part of its power, its pernicious power, to exploit and oppress in myriad forms.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, on page 9, you say that because of this shifting idea of race, that underscores how much of a fabrication it is and a myth that's used to protect those social hierarchies in these multiple contexts, which I think is really a valuable insight there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the other side of it, is thinking about race not just as a sort of theory and as a myth, but also the way in which it's used, right? What context is it being used in? In what way is it being deployed to uphold one regime or another, here the establishment of colonialism and slavery, but elsewhere for other reasons.
Definitely. So in terms of your sort of overarching argument related to this, of course, you say on page 1 that early French Caribbean reconstructions of masculinity and femininity sustained occupation, slavery, and nation ideas of race, like we've just been talking about. And throughout the book, you talk about several groups of people who were subject to this evolving form of, say, stereotyping during this early French colonial process. So I was just wondering if you could do a little bit of a rundown of these groups and how they are characterized. So in terms of African women as compared to European or French women, how did French authors and colonists characterize African versus European women over time during the 17th century?
It's a really important question and a really hard one to answer, because there's no one answer, right? And that is part of the interest of it too, is to identify the contradictions in the different stereotypes, tropes that emerge in the variety of texts I look at. And so in that way, I try to remain, because my corpus is quite diverse, I try to remain very conscious of the kind of frameworks in which to read my text. So thinking about, you know, what is the presence of religion here, of Counter-Reformation ecclesiastical goals versus political goals versus a kind of moralistic control or natural historical interpretation. And of course, I can't tease those out either. So they're all kind of overlapping and influencing each other. But often I see, all of this to say, often I see completely contradictory portraits of one group or another, sometimes in the same text, sometimes in very different contexts. So to talk about African women and women of African descent in a lot of these texts is extremely interesting. I mean, certainly there's such important work that's been done on this question in the Anglophone world, of course, with Jennifer Morgan's work and many others. And to some extent also in the Francophone world, about the kinds of stereotypes that were built up around women of African descent and African women in the context of slavery. I'm thinking about studies of slavery in the Francophone world that focus on enslaved women by Arlette Gauthier and Bernard Mouat, and then more recently, Jessica Marie Johnson. And so there's definitely this tradition of identifying the different kinds of stereotypes that we see around African women. And then I think there's important work to be done in an intersectional lens, but also in a kind of placing that to understand constructions of whiteness and white femininity. So, to answer your question more directly, you can see this complete range of, to take the most kind of potent, I think, example, a kind of criminalization of enslaved women's sexuality as being, as it's identified as a threat to social order, in especially legal cases and correspondence with the Crown associated with what is to be done to essentially sustain slavery in the face of interracial sex and children born of interracial sex. And that, you know, of course, that gives us a perspective into the sexual violence that's present there, but it's often coded through this kind of criminalization of women of African descent. On the other hand, however, we have this complete opposite portrait of enslaved women in particular, and this comes up most especially in missionaries' texts, which is an extremely important part of my corpus that is so unique to the French colonial project in terms of the kinds of texts written. And so these give us, on the other hand, this kind of several portraits of, for example, a kind of exemplary conversion of chastity that is very much in line with Catholic norms, where there'll be these detailed portraits of individual women. Now, we can see this as, in its own way, justifying the missionary presence and project, but it also gives us some really interesting examples that at times can be interpreted as resistance. But all of that to say, we have both. And sometimes in the same text, most interestingly, I think, in the narrative texts by missionaries, because they tend to give us more particulars, but still often deploy these developing racialized stereotypes. On the other hand, we have both as well, and I'm simplifying here, but we have both those portraits as well for white women, but they're used differently. And they're shifting depending on context. And so this is what I was really interested in identifying and delving into, sort of the detailed shifting representations of white women by focusing on French women sent to the colonies for various reasons. And a French scholar named Elsa Dorlin identified this kind of idea of that contrast. But I wanted to delve, and she frames it as a kind of Black women being used as a kind of whitening force, a kind of bleaching force for white women, which she frames really succinctly, and I wanted to go into the details for the 17th century Caribbean. And so that's where we see, whereas the texts and even the images, the engravings that come up about French women sent from the Hôpital Général are themselves viewed as criminal and especially characterized as debauchées, you know, these debauched women, women of ill repute. But then there's also this shift of women religious being sent to the colonies who insist upon a kind of chaste heroism for white women. And then as we see things evolve, there are at the same time, not only these heroic women religious, but also the defense of a kind of chaste white French bride, une fille à marier, that is to be protected and is one of the ways to uphold a kind of developing color line, we could say. So those things are all shifting and contradicting each other as well, but that would be to answer the question in broad terms regarding opposing representations of women of African descent, African women, and French women who were arriving in the colonies, and then sometimes being born in the colonies, and that sort of brings up a whole other set of concerns as well. But I hope that starts to answer your questions.
Definitely. And does this process happen in a parallel format with men as well, or masculinity?
I think so. And I think it's an understudied question to a certain extent, to identify the role of shifting ideas of masculinity. So to look at intersectional gender, not just around ideas of blackness and femininity, but also whiteness and masculinity. And so that's why I focused on flibustier, the privateers, and the, again, contradictory portraits of them as both these heroic, idealized men, but also these potentially kind of savage and over-violent men, and the ways in which that concept became opposed not only to men of African descent, African men as well, but also indigenous men and indigenous women, which is another group that I try to examine in the study. So absolutely, there is a parallel, but of course different deployment of masculine tropes that happens around various groups of men and women, right? Because masculinity and femininity don't just apply to men and women separately.
Yeah, that I will say that the it's an unexpected but welcome addition to include these privateers, these filibusters or pirates, however you want to describe them, into a study of race in the French Caribbean context, because I don't think that that has been done as much as it should be in terms of really examining these people and the characterizations of them and how they fit into ideas of masculinity and race in this period. It's really, really fascinating intervention there, I think.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, and there's been, I think, you know, there are, again, a really, I think that there's probably an Anglophone equivalent, but the texts around the flibustier in French are just so compelling. There are these narratives, and scholars in French literary studies have done some really excellent work on that, and specifically Doris Garraway, I think she defines this noble white savage in some of those texts. And what I was trying to do is, again, bring it into this network of intersectional shifting ideas of race and look at that through the lens of other portraits of masculinity that were emerging at the same time in narrative texts, but also in colonial correspondence and legal cases, legal codes.
So you also speak often in your book about ability and disability. And I'm wondering, you've talked about masculinity and femininity, but where does sort of ability fit into your study as well?
So this is maybe a less obvious intersectional discourse to bring into conversation with race and gender. But as my work has evolved, it's become more and more clear that it's an essential component. So, and I was fortunate enough to have a reader point me in that direction. So I'm very grateful for that. But to start with the idea of what is the role of conceptions of disability in the history of slavery, we can turn to recent monographs by Dia Boster, Jennifer Barclay, and Stephanie Hunt Kennedy, who all have done studies on the Anglophone world. And, you know, so we can't just take what's been done in English speaking contexts, mostly North America, though Hunt Kennedy focuses on the Caribbean in a really helpful way for my study. But, you know, broadly speaking, the idea is that disability is useful for understanding slavery and had a central role in the racialization of slavery in two ways. So one would be thinking about the kind of metaphorical deployment of capable bodies or incapable bodies in intersectional, racist, and sexist texts or representations. And yet it's also important not to just see disability as a metaphor and as a discursive one, especially in the context of slavery, where it was a systematically debilitating order, right? And so the injury to physical bodies and to minds as well was essential. And so considering that side of things, and more the kind of question of debility, thinking about how, for example, Jasbir Puar has defined that this kind of idea of intentional injury, but not death, as one of the important forces in slavery, both in a kind of metaphorical and material sense. And I find it really useful to think about both of those sides when I'm thinking about all of this, but especially disability, thinking about how someone like Sammy Schalk has emphasized those two realms, both the material and the metaphorical, when talking about disability.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I think a fantastic example of that that you bring in is this idea of castrating African and African-descended men, both literally and figuratively, with depicting them as sort of failed fathers or emasculated people, but also literally castrating them whenever they would. Sometimes castrating them when they would rebel or flee from the plantation machine. So, a really interesting way that those two ideas intersect, both physical and theoretical.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes in opposite contexts, right, where you would expect something to be more literal is more figurative, and vice versa, I think. So yeah, thanks for bringing that example in.
So obviously there's so many more examples we could talk about and so much more content we could talk about, but I do want to give listeners an incentive to go out and engage with this book themselves. So I want to move on to a couple of questions about sort of your larger questions, not about the context, but and the content, but about your process of writing this book. So first off, what inspired you to make these arguments to write this monograph?
You know, a long process, but I would say the important part of that process was this increasing interest in confronting and better understanding an oppressive past that is understudied. You know, that early modern literary studies, for example, could do well to think more about race and colonialism. And on the other hand, contemporary Francophone studies tend to emphasize a much more modern period and could think about this early context a bit more. So without even getting into the kind of political engagement there, you know, I saw in those two fields a connection to be made and a genuine curiosity I had too, as someone who had been studying 20th, 21st century Caribbean literature in French, to understand the texts from the colonial period, and also sort of taking that on as a project of confronting white supremacy and white privilege as it's constructed in the French-speaking world, but as a way for me as a white woman to also think about the sorts of privileges I inherit and that are embedded in my experience. So there's a personal level to it as well that felt, that partially compelled me to delve into the topic.
Yeah. No, that's extremely powerful and obviously has extreme relevance to today's, unfortunately, to today's climate. And so I'll ask you then, you know, do you think that there are implications of this work to present conceptions of race, gender, and ability and disability? And can this apply to contexts beyond the French Caribbean colonial regime?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I think, as I sort of alluded to earlier, I think confronting the way in which race is constructed and is built up can help us see in the past, can help us see what ways it's built up and is a fiction in the present. At the same time, considering the very real effects it has and the real power and violent implications that it holds. And so I think we could take some of the tropes that I study and sort of see, you know, it's tricky because I don't want to say this is the same thing, especially to a North American context, but we sort of question the way in which a trope that gets deployed over and over and over gets reused to new ends. So, and becomes so familiar that it almost feels natural, right? So to denaturalize racism and intersectional tropes as much as anything, and insisting on the specificity, but also the kind of repetition. So I think it's absolutely relevant. And then there is the context of, you know, I try to always think about my classroom and what's the relevance there to the sort of knowledge that I bring to my students. And I teach in a Francophone studies program, meaning that I teach students who are, you know, majors in the language and cultures and literatures and histories of the Francophone world. So not in history. And so it also feels extremely important to me to be talking about the relevance of this history, not just for the English-speaking world, and also not just for a more recent history, right? So, yeah, and so I think the main implication of this work and of this project is sort of the decoding of this violent history. But I think there are also moments of pushback and challenge and resistance and these sort of strategies of disruption that also start to emerge in the project that are just as important and that we can learn from just as much as well. So I think, you know, these are important questions when we think about our lived reality and political situation in terms of murder and in terms of reproductive harm and many of the issues that plague us today, I think, can be informed by this deeper history.
Where do you think this work, this history, this monograph fits in with previous historical studies of the early French Caribbean?
I would say that the first is just to focus on the earlier period, mm-hmm. right? To have a sustained study of the 17th century as a period unto itself, mm-hmm. not just as the sort of beginning of the 18th century in terms of the French Caribbean. And in so doing, showing the sorts of specificity, and for me, the interest is the flux, the shifts, the contradictions, which are particularly evident in this period, as well as an ongoing investment in understanding the intertwined ideas of gender, race, and disability here. So I'm in conversation with work, as I said before, on enslaved women has been extremely important for me developing a knowledge around strategies for identifying the presence of enslaved women in the archive and dealing with it in what I hope is an ethical and intentional way, mm-hmm. given the amount of violence that surrounds this archive. So that's why, again, work in the Anglophone world by someone like Jennifer Morgan or Marisa Fuentes has been so influential for me in looking at gender of various groups in the French Caribbean, but also work in literary studies on a related corpus by Michael Harrigan has an important work on the sorts of narratives that I'm looking at here. And so to continue to make this earlier period more visible and the specificity of the forms of gender, but also gendered violence that were taking place and taking shape.
And related, I would say, to the contribution that this monograph gives, the voice that it gives to people who perhaps are voiceless, or to speak more specifically about historical silences. You cite, and I'm reminded in your work about the work of Rolf Trujillo, who talks about these silences in the archives, these intentional ways that people have privileged certain systems of knowledge, certain sources, certain books to craft a narrative of this colonial period, this Caribbean colonial period, to serve their own purposes. And yet how many voices and perspectives are missing because of that process. There's a lot of silences in the archives, of course. A lot of enslaved people are not privileged in the historical archive. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that and tell us how you were able to overcome such silences to write this monograph.
So I don't think I have overcome them. I think at some point I've pointed to them is all that can be done. But in other senses, I think you're absolutely right. We don't have first person accounts by enslaved people in the early French Caribbean. We don't. And so there are in the actual archive, there are silences, yes, but there are also presences. And I think pointing to the possibilities that those presences can enable or render possible is increasingly important to me. Or feels increasingly possible to me, I guess. So, in terms of the silences in the actual primary sources, they are certainly there, and they're especially there in terms of who is speaking for whom. On the other hand, there's the other fact of the silence in the production of our narratives, right? And those can be completely sorted out. But I would say the second is something that I engage with in a very different way. You know, if I think about, in history and in colonial history and Atlantic history, this might not seem like an intervention, but in literary studies, I think that it is the idea of considering the 17th century, the reign of Louis XIV, as a period of racism is a silence, right? Is me responding to a silence. So centering on the Caribbean in itself in a way is countering a silence. But certainly most of this project is centered on identifying the violence, identifying the oppressive discourses. And by the time I was done with it, that was feeling like not all the work to be done at all. And so it's why I'm thinking more and more about other approaches to engaging with this work, right? And I think that it was and it is important to continue to confront and deal with and understand better the oppressive discourses, and that especially for the early French context, because the work is starting to be done in important ways, but there's a lot of work to do for understanding that, and especially, sort of thinking about the broader Francophone world and specifically French Republican ideas that make it very easy to deny this history and especially its implications in the present. That is also important, but I'm thinking more and more in my current work about how do we look closer and read creatively these documents to resolve more the silences in the documents themselves. And I, in a way, there is a lot to work with, especially with something like these missionary narratives that give us portraits of individuals, anecdotes, detailed descriptions that are extremely rich, even if they're still filtered through problematic perspectives. You know, there's a responsibility, I think, there to take them seriously and continue to look for more complicated and more sort of polyvocal readings of that.
Well, speaking of more work to be done and the constant need of looking at all these sources and trying to figure out and uncover these silences, what projects are on the horizon for you?
Very graceful transition there. So what I'm focused on now is, well, first of all, I'm relieved to just be able to read a lot right now. Like, I just want to sit and read and learn right now is very much the place I'm in. And so I'm enjoying that. But also, in more specifically, the ongoing book project that I'm working on is about madness and mental disability. So if this project was more focused on the production of a racism that is very much corporeal, I'm now looking at ideas of madness. And I'm trying to emphasize in this new project, not only the kind of racialization of pathologies, but also looking at moments where madness comes up as moments of disruption to this violence, to these oppressive forces. And so that's where I'm trying to do as much reading as possible to learn about creative ethical strategies for reading the presence of, for example, enslaved people. And for example, enslaved people who were returned to merchants because they were deemed folle, mad in French. And so kind of revisiting these moments. So that's what I'm working on now. And I'm, again, trying to look at it in a lens that will also be informed by ideas of intersectionality and more specifically that will not just be centered on the construction of Blackness, but also of whiteness in relation to these issues. So that's what I'm working on now. And in the meantime, I'm just trying to understand a bit more strategies that scholars have deployed, people like Marisa Fuentes, Saidiya Hartman, of course, but many others as well. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, we're looking forward to engaging with that work once it's finished, but in no pressure, but in hopefully in the near future there. Dr. Williard, thanks so much for your time today and for this wonderful conversation. The book, Engendering Island Sexuality, Reproduction, and Violence in the Early French Caribbean, is out now via the University of Nebraska Press. And this is R. Grant Clauser saying thank you so much to all our listeners for tuning in, and see you next time.